life from my private life. All of my best laid plans, however, go out the window as soon as I arrive at her place and find her waiting for me. She's wearing jean shorts, cutoffs like Daisy May. Her legs are long and tan and muscular, and I can't stop staring at them.
What? She says, glancing down at her calves. Did I cut myself shaving?
No, you're perfect. I mean, you look perfect. I mean, I shake my head. Did you talk to your grandmother this morning?
Yeah. Sage leads me into her home. She's a little scared, but she's expecting us.
Last night before we left, Minka had agreed to look at a photo spread. I'll make her as comfortable as I can, I promise. Sage's house is the visual representation of that favorite sweatshirt you own, the one that you search through your drawer for because it's so comfortable. The couch is overstuffed, the light creamy and soft. There's always something baking. It's the kind of place you could settle down for a few moments and wake up years later because you never left. It's completely orthogonal to my apartment in Washington, which is full of black leather and chrome and right angles.
I like your place, I blurt out.
She glances at me oddly.
You were here yesterday.
I know, it's just very cozy. Sage looks around.
My mother was good at that, at drawing people in.
She opens up her mouth and then shuts it again abruptly. You were going to say that you're not, I guess. She shrugs.
I'm good at pushing people away.
Not all people, I say. And we both know I'm talking about last night. Sage hesitates, as if she's about to tell me something, but then turns and walks into the kitchen.
So what color did you decide on?
Color?
For your nail polish.
She picks up a mug of tea and hands it to me. I take a sip and realize she's put in milk but no sugar, just the way I took it last night at the cafe. There's something about that, her remembering, that makes me feel like I've taken flight.
I was gonna go with cherry red, but that's so FBI, I reply.
A little too flashy for us DOJ folks.
Wise decision.
And you? I ask. Did you glean any wisdom from People magazine?
I did what you told me to do.
She answers, and suddenly the mood is dropped like a stone in a pond.
I saw Joseph.
And?
I can't do it. I can't talk to him and pretend I don't know what I know now.
Sage shakes her head.
I think he might be upset with me.
Just then my cell phone rings, and I see my boss's number flashing.
I have to take this,
I apologize, and I drift into the living room to answer the call. He has a logistical question about a prosecution memo that I edited on a different case. I walk him through some of the changes I made, and why, and by the time I hang up and walk back into the kitchen, I see Sage, drinking her coffee, perusing the front page of Reiner Hartmann's SS file. What the hell are you doing? I ask. That's classified. She looks up, a deer in headlights.
I wanted to see if I can identify him, too.
I grab the folder. I can't show her Reiner's file. She's a civilian. But I hold up that front page, the one from his SS file, that gives his name, address, birth date, blood type, and photo. Here, I say, offering a quick peek of the image. The parted hair. The pale eyes you can't quite see.
He looks nothing like Joseph now, Sage murmurs. I don't know if I could pick him up out of a lineup.
Well, I reply, let's hope your grandmother doesn't agree. Once, a historian in my office named Simran brought me a picture of Angelina Jolie. It was on his iPhone, and it was a party scene. There were balloons all over the place and a birthday cake on the table, and in the foreground, pouting, was Angelina. Wow, I said. Where'd you take that?
She's my cousin.
Your cousin is Angelina Jolie? I asked.
Nope, Simran said. But she looks just like her, don't you think?
As it turns out, witness identification is frequently total crap. It's often the weakest part of the proof phase of criminal law enforcement. It's why DNA testing is continually overturning the convictions of rapists who are identified positively by their victims. There really are a very limited number of facial variations, and we tend to make errors of judgment, which is great for Simran's cousin, but less great if you work for the Department of Justice and you're trying to get an eyewitness ID. Minka's cane hangs over the edge of the kitchen table, upon which is a glass mug of tea and an empty plate. I'm sitting beside her. Daisy, her caretaker, stands with her arms crossed in the doorway of the kitchen.
Voila,
Sage announces, and she sets down one perfectly baked roll on the china. The roll is knotted on the top. Crystals of sugar dot the surface. I don't have to wait for Minka to break it open to know that inside is cinnamon and chocolate. That this is the roll her father once baked for her.
I thought maybe you'd miss these, Sage says.
Minka gasps. She turns the small roll over in her hands.
You made this. But how?
I guessed, Sage admits.
When did she have time to bake this? During the morning, maybe? After she met with Joseph? I stare at Sage, watching her face as her grandmother breaks open the pastry and takes the first bite.
Oh, it's just like my father used to make,
Minka sighs.
Just like I remember.
Your memory is what I'm counting on, I say, sensing a perfect segue. I know this isn't easy, so I really appreciate you making the sacrifice. Are you ready? I wait for Minka to meet my gaze. She nods. In front of her, I place a photo spread of 8 Nazi war criminals. Ginevra has outdone herself in both speed and precision. The picture of Rainer Hartmann, the same one Sage had been looking at earlier in his SS file, is on the bottom left. There are 4 photos in the row above it and 3 more beside it, which depict other men of generally similar appearance wearing identical Nazi uniforms. This way, I'm asking Minka to compare apples to apples. If Reiner's photo was the only picture of a man in uniform, it could be seen as prejudicial. Sage, sitting beside her grandmother, looks down at the spread, too. The 8 individuals all have the same parted, slick blonde hair as Rainer Hartmann. They're all facing the same direction. They look like young movie stars from the 1940s, smooth-shaven and strong-jawed. Matinee idols for a macabre documentary. It's not necessarily the case that anyone in this photo array was at the camp, Minka, but I'd like you to look at the faces and see if anything jumps out at you. Minka picks up the paper with unsteady hands.
We did not know them by name.
That doesn't matter. She passes a finger over each of the 8 faces, as if it's a pistol held to the forehead of each man. Is it my imagination, or does it hover over Rainer Hartmann's portrait?
It's too hard,
Minka says, shaking her head. She pushes away the photo spread.
I do not want to remember any more.
I understand,
but you do not understand,
she interrupts.
You're not just asking me to point to a photograph. You're asking me to poke a hole in a dam because you are thirsty. Even though I will end up drowning in the process.
Please, I beg. But Minka buries her face in her hands. The anguish on Sage's face is even more profound than it is on Minka's. But that's what love is, isn't it? When it hurts you more to see someone else suffer than it does to take the pain yourself.
We're done, Sage announces. I'm sorry, Leo, but I can't put her through this.
Give her a chance to make up her own mind, I suggest. Minka is turned away, lost in a memory. Daisy swoops in like an avenging angel and wraps an arm around her fragile charge.
You want to rest, Miss Minka? Because it sure looks to me like you need to lie down a bit.
She glares daggers at me as she helps Sage's grandmother to her feet, hands her the cane, and leads her down the hall. Sage seems as if she's breaking in half, watching her grandmother go.
I should never have brought you here,
she whispers. I've seen this before, Sage. It's a shock to the system, seeing the face of someone who hurt you. Other survivors have had the same reaction, but have managed to pull themselves together and make a valid ID. I know she spent over half a century keeping these feelings buried. I get that. And I understand that it's painful to rip the band-aid off the wound.
This isn't a band-aid,
Sage argues.
This is surgery without anesthesia. And I don't really give a damn about the other survivors you've seen going through this. I just care about my grandmother.
Standing abruptly, she heads down the hallway, leaving me with the photo array. I look down at the spread, at Reiner Hartmann's face. There is nothing in it that suggests the evil beneath the surface. Instead, we are forced to approximate what toxic cocktail of cells and schooling might allow a boy raised with scruples to be led to an act of genocide. The uneaten roll that Sage baked lies on the plate in two halves, like a broken heart. I sigh and reach for my briefcase, ready to slip the photos inside. But at the last minute I stop. I pick up the plate with the roll on it and walk to Minka's bedroom. Behind the door are soft voices. Taking a deep breath, I knock. Minka sits in an overstuffed chair, her feet raised on an ottoman.
"Stop fussing, Sage,"
she says, exasperated, as Daisy opens the bedroom door for me.
"I'm all right."
I love that she's full of piss and vinegar. I love that she's tough as nails one moment and soft as suede the next. It is what got her through the worst era of history, I'm sure, and what has kept her going since. And it's what she's passed down to her granddaughter, even if Sage doesn't know it. They both look up as I enter, holding the roll and the photos.
"You have got to be kidding me," Sage mutters.
"Minka," I say, handing her the platter. "I thought you might want this. Sage went to the trouble of baking it because she thought it would give you a bit of peace. That's what I wanted to do today, too. What you lived through? It wasn't fair. But it's also not fair for you to live in a country where you have to share your homeland with your former tormentors.
Help me, Minka. Please."
Sage gets to her feet.
"Leo," she says tightly, "get out of here now."
"Wait. Wait."
Minka waves me closer and holds out her hand for the photo spread. The plate with the roll lies balanced on her lap. In her hands is the photo array. She traces the faces, as if the names of the men could be read in Braille. Slowly, Minka brings her finger down on the photograph of Reiner Hartmann. She taps his face twice.
"This is him."
"Who?"
She glances up at me. "I told you. We did not know the SS officers by name."
"But you recognize the face?"
"Anywhere," Minka says. "I would never forget the man who killed my best friend."
We have tuna sandwiches with Minka for lunch. I talk about how my grandfather taught me to play bridge and how bad I was at it. To say we lost catastrophically would be an understatement, I tell her. So when we left, I asked my grandpa how I should have played the hand. He said,
"Under an assumed name."
Minka laughs.
"One day you will come back here, Leo, and you will be my partner. I'll teach you everything you need to know."
"It's a date, I promise." I wipe my mouth with my napkin. "And thank you for, well, for everything. But Sage and I probably should be going." She hugs her grandmother goodbye. Minka holds Sage a little tighter than normal, which is something I've seen other survivors do. It's as if, now that they have something good in their lives, they cannot bear to see it go. I hold her hands, cool and brittle as fallen leaves. "What you've done today, I can't even begin to thank you for. But..."
"But I am not finished," Minka says. "You want me to go to court to do it all over again?"
"If you're up to it, yes," I admit. "In the past, the testimonies of the survivors have been hugely important, and yours isn't just an identification. You have direct experience watching him commit a murder."
"Will I have to see him?"
I hesitate. "If you don't want to, we can arrange to videotape your testimony." Minka looks at me.
"Who would be there?"
Me, a historian from my office, a cameraman, defense counsel, and Sage, if you'd like. She nods.
This I can do. But if I had to see him, I don't think...
Her voice trails off. I nod, respecting her decision. On impulse, I kiss her goodbye on the cheek. You're class act, Minka. In the car, Sage pounces.
So, what happens next? You got what you needed, right?
We got more than we needed. Your grandmother was a gold mine. It's one thing to give eyewitness identification and to have her point out the Schutzhaftlagerführer, but she did something even better. She told us about something in his SS file that no one except my office would have known. Sage shakes her head.
I don't understand.
It seems almost ludicrous, but there was a right way and a wrong way to kill the prisoners at the concentration camps. Officers who did not follow the rules would find themselves written up with disciplinary infractions. It was one thing to shoot a prisoner who didn't have the strength to stand up anymore, but to kill a prisoner for no reason was to kill a worker, and the Nazis needed those workers. Granted, no one in charge cared enough about the prisoners to do much more than give the offending officer a slap on the hand, but every now and then in an SS man's file, there's a mention of the disciplinary proceeding. I look up at Sage.
In Reiner Hartmann's file, there's a paragraph about him going in front of a review committee for an unauthorized shooting of a female prisoner.
Daria?
Sage asks. I nod. With your grandmother's testimony, that's a pretty airtight lock that this particular guy she identified and the man who told you his name used to be Reiner Hartmann are one and the same.
Why didn't you tell me that was in the file?
Because you don't have government clearance, I say. And because I couldn't risk you influencing what your grandmother had to say. She sinks back in the passenger seat.
So he was telling me the truth. Joseph. Reiner. Whatever his name is.
It looks that way. I can see a flurry of emotions move like storms across her face as she tries to reconcile Joseph Weber with his previous persona. It's different somehow once that confirmation's been made. And in Sage's case, she is wrestling, too, with betraying a man she had considered a friend. You did the right thing, I say, coming to me. What he asked you to do for him, that isn't justice. This is. She doesn't look up.
Do you arrest him right away?
No. I go home. At that, Sage's head snaps up.
Now?
I nod. There's a lot I have to do before we move forward. I don't want to go. I'd like to ask Sage out to dinner, actually. I'd like to watch her bake something from scratch. I just like to watch her, period.
So you're going to go to the airport?
Sage asks. Does it seem like she's a little disappointed, too, to hear that I'm leaving? But that's just me reading into the situation. She has a boyfriend. Granted, he happens to have a wife, but the bottom line is that Sage isn't looking for anyone right now. Yes, I say. I'll call my secretary. There's probably a flight back to D.C. around dinner time. Ask me to stick around, I think. Sage meets my gaze.
Well, if you have to go, you probably should turn on the ignition.
My face flushes with embarrassment. This pregnant pause between us wasn't full of unspoken words, just a vehicle that hadn't been started yet. Suddenly her phone begins to ring. Frowning, she shifts in her seat to pull it from the pocket of her shorts.
Yes? This is Sage Singer.
Her eyes widen.
Is he all right? What happened? Yes, I understand. Thank you.
When she hangs up, she stares at the phone in her hand as if it's a grenade.
That was the hospital, Sage announces. Joseph's been admitted.
From where we were hiding, behind the woodshed on Baruch Beiler's property, we could see it all. Casimir chained on the makeshift stage, the wild rage in Damien's eyes as he screamed at the teen, his spittle flecking the boy's face. Drunk with power, Damien addressed the villagers who huddled beneath the blazing blue sky. Their captain of the guard had found not one perpetrator, but two. Surely this meant they were safe now, that they could go back to the way they had been? Was I the only one who knew that wasn't possible? No, Alex knew it too. It was why he had tried to atone for his brother's sins. "My friends," Damien announced, spreading his arms wide, "we have broken the beast." There was a roar as the crowd swallowed his words. "We will bury the Upior the way he should have been buried the first time, face down at a crossroads with an oak stake through the heart." Beside me, Alex was chafing. I held him back with a gentle hand on his arm. "Don't," I whispered. "Can't you see? This is all about setting a trap for you." "My brother can't help himself. It doesn't make what he does right, but I cannot sit here." Damien beckoned a soldier behind him. "First, we will make sure that he remains dead, and there's only one way to do that." The cadet stepped forward, holding a wicked, curved scythe. The blade winked like a jewel. He raised it over his head as Casimir squinted into the fierce sunlight, trying to see what was happening above him. "Three," Damien counted. "Two." He turned, fixing his gaze directly at the brush where we were hidden, so that I realized he had known we were there all along. "One." The blade sliced through the air, a scream of metal that severed Casimir's head from his body in a single blow. Blood flooded the stage. It spilled over the edge of the wood and ran in runnels over the ground toward the crowd. "No!" Alex cried. He tore away from me and rushed the stage as soldiers ran to apprehend him. But he was no longer a man. He bit and clawed, throwing off seven men with the force of an entire army as the crowd scattered to take cover. When only Damien remained, without his protective escort, Alex stepped forward and snarled. Damien lifted his sword, and then he dropped it, turned tail, and ran. Alex was on him before Damien was halfway across the village square. He tackled the captain, turning Damien so that he landed on his back, so that the clear, bright sky would be the last thing he ever saw. In one single, wrenching tear, Alex ripped out his heart.
Sage. Hospitals smell like death. A little too clean and a little too cold. The minute I walk inside, I've dialed my life back 3 years, and I'm here watching my mother die by degrees. Leo and I stand in the hallway, near Joseph's room. The doctors have told me that Joseph was brought here to have his stomach pumped. Apparently he had an adverse medical reaction, and a Meals on Wheels volunteer found him unconscious on the floor. It makes me wonder who's got Eva now, if someone will be taking care of her tonight. Although Leo is not allowed into the room, I am. Joseph listed me as his next of kin, which is a pretty interesting relationship for someone you've asked to kill you. "I don't like hospitals," I say. "No one does." "I don't know what to do," I whisper. "You have to talk to him," Leo answers. "You want me to convince him to get better so that you can ship him out of the country and have him die in a jail cell somewhere?" Leo considers this. "Yes, after he's convicted." Maybe it's because he's being so blunt. It shocks me back to the present. I nod, take a deep breath, and walk into Joseph's room. In spite of what my grandmother has said, in spite of that photo in the spread that Leo created, he is just an elderly man. A husk of the brute he used to be. With his thin limbs jutting from a pale blue hospital gown, his silver hair disheveled, it's hard to imagine that the very sight of this man once crippled others with fear. Joseph is asleep, his left arm thrown up over his head. The scar he showed me once before, on the inside of his upper arm, is clearly visible, a shiny dark button the size of a quarter, with ragged edges. Glancing over my shoulder, I see Leo in the hallway, still watching me, He lifts his hand, letting me know he's still watching. With my cell phone, I snap a picture of Joseph's scar so Leo can see it later. I hurriedly stuff my phone back into my shorts as a nurse enters the room. "You're the girl he's been talking about?" she says. "Cinnamon, right?" "Sage," I say cheerfully, wondering if she's seen me taking the picture. "Same spice rack, different jar." The nurse looks at me oddly. "Well, your friend Mr. Weber is a very lucky man to have been found when he was." I should have been the one to find him. The thought slips into my mind like the blade of a knife. As his one good friend, I should have been there if he needed me. But instead, I was the one who'd argued with him and stormed out of his house. The problem is that I'm Joseph Weber's friend, but Rainer Hartmann is my enemy. So what do I do, now that they are the same man? "What happened to him?" I ask. "Ate a salt substitute while he was taking aldactone. It made his potassium levels skyrocket. Could have put him into cardiac arrest." I sit down on the edge of the bed and hold Joseph's hand. A hospital band is looped around his wrist. Joseph Weber, DOB, 42018. B positive. If only they knew that wasn't who he really was. Joseph's fingers twitch against mine, and I drop his hand as if he's on fire.
"You came,"
he rasps. "Of course I did."
"Eva?"
"I'm going to take her home with me. She'll be fine." "Mr. Weber?" the nurse interrupts. "How are you feeling? Do you have any pain?" He shakes his head. "Could we just have a minute?" I ask. She nods. "I'll come back to take your temperature and blood pressure in 5, the nurse says. We both wait until she is left to speak again.
"You didn't do this by accident, did you?" I whisper. "I am not stupid. The pharmacist told me about drug interactions. I chose to ignore him."
"Why?"
"If you would not help me die, then I had to do it myself. But I should have known it was no use."
He waves an arm around the hospital room.
"I told you before. This is my punishment. No matter what I do, I survive."
"I never said I wouldn't help you," I reply.
"You were angry at me for telling you the truth."
"Yes," I admit, "I was. It's really hard to hear."
"You stormed out of my house."
"You've had almost 70 years to live with this, Joseph. You have to give me more than 5 minutes. I lower my voice. "What you did, what you said you did, makes me sick. But if I, you know, do what you asked me to do, now I'm doing it out of anger, out of hate. And that brings me down to your level."
"I knew you would be upset," Joseph confesses. "But you were not my first choice."
This surprises me. There is someone else in this town who knows what Joseph did and who hasn't turned him in?
"Your mother," Joseph says. "She is the first one I asked."
My jaw drops. "You knew my mother?"
"I met her years ago, when I was working at the high school. The world religions teacher invited her to talk about her faith. I met her in the teacher's room during lunch very briefly. She said she was hardly a model Jew, but that she was better than none."
That sounds like my mother. I can even vaguely remember her going to speak in front of my sister's class, and how embarrassed Pepper was to have her there. I bet my sister would give anything to have my mother in such close proximity now. The thought makes my throat close tight.
"We got to talking, and she of course noticed my accent, and said that her mother-in-law had been a survivor from Poland."
I notice that he uses the past tense when talking about my Nana, I do not correct him. I do not want him to know anything about her at all. What did you tell her?
That I was sent abroad to study during the war. For years I tried to cross paths with her again. I felt it was fate that we had met. Not only was she a Jew, but she was related by marriage to a survivor. She was as close as I could come to forgiveness. I think of what Leo's reaction to this would be. One Jew can't substitute for another. You were going to ask her to kill you? Help me die, Joseph corrects. But then I learned she had passed. And then I met you. I did not know at first you were her daughter, but when it became clear, I knew there was a reason our paths had crossed. I knew I had to ask of you what I did not get a chance to ask of your mother. His eyes, blue and rheumy, fill with tears. I won't die. I can't die. I know you must think it is ridiculous of me to believe this, but it is true. I find myself thinking of my grandmother's story, of the Upior who begged for release instead of an eternity of misery. You're hardly a vampire, Joseph. That does not mean I haven't been cursed. Look at me. I should be dead now, several times over. I have been locked for nearly 70 years. And for nearly 70 years, I've been searching for a key. Maybe you are the one who has it. Leo would say Joseph has stalked me and my family. Leo would say that even now, Joseph sees Jews as only a means to an end, not as individuals, but as pawns. But if you seek forgiveness, doesn't that automatically mean you cannot be a monster? By definition, doesn't that desperation make you human again? I wonder what my mother had thought of Joseph Weber. I reach for Joseph's hand. This hand, which held the gun that killed my grandmother's best friend, and God knows how many others. I'll do it, I say. Although at this point, I'm not sure if I'm lying for Leo's sake or telling the truth for my own. Leo and I drive to Joseph's house, but he will not come inside with me.
Without a search warrant, not on your life.
I guess it's different, since I'm just there to pick up the dog, not to hunt for incriminating material. Joseph's spare key is kept in a sliding compartment in the bottom of a stone frog that sits on his porch. When I open the door, Eva comes running out to meet me and barks frantically. It's okay, I tell the little dachshund. He's gonna be all right. Today, anyway. Who will take the dog when he's extradited? Inside, the kitchen is a mess. A plate has been overturned and broken. The food is gone, a perk for Eva, I'm guessing. A chair is lying on its side. On the table is the salt substitute Joseph must have eaten. I right the chair and clean up the broken china and sweep the floor. Then I throw the salt substitute in the trash and wash the dishes in the sink and wipe down the counters. I rummage through Joseph's pantry to find Eva's dog food. There are boxes of Quaker instant oatmeal and rice-a-roni, mustard, rotini pasta. There are at least 3 bags of Doritos. It looks incredibly ordinary, although I don't know what I was expecting a former Nazi to subsist on. When I go looking for a crate or a doggy bed, I find myself standing at the threshold of Joseph's bedroom. The bed is neatly made with a white blanket. The sheets are flowered with tiny violets. There are still 2 dressers in the room, one with a jewelry box on top and a woman's hairbrush. On one nightstand sit an alarm clock, a telephone, and a dog's chew toy. On the other nightstand is an Alice Hoffman novel, with a bookmark still in place, and a jar of rose-scented hand cream. There is something so heartbreaking about this, about Joseph's inability to put away the trappings of his wife's life. But this man, who loved his wife and loves his dog and who eats junk food, also killed other human beings without blinking. I take the chew toy, and with Eva still dancing at my heels, head back to the car where Leo is waiting. With the dog on my lap, gnawing at the ragged cuffs of my shorts, we drive to my house. "He said he knew my mother," I tell Leo. Leo glances at me. "What?" I explain to him what Joseph told me. What would he have done if he knew my grandmother was alive? For a moment, Leo's quiet. "How do you know he doesn't?" "What are you saying?" "He could be playing you. He's lied to you before. Hell, he lied to the whole world for well over half a century. Maybe he figured out who Minka was and is feeling you out to see if she remembers what he did." "Do you really think after all these years he'd be trying to clear his name against a theft charge?" "No," Leo says. "But after all these years, he might still want to silence anyone who could identify him as a Nazi." "That's a little unrealistic, don't you think?" "So was the final solution, but it got pretty far," Leo points out. "Maybe I'd believe you if Joseph hadn't asked me to kill him. Because he knows you're not capable of it, so instead, he strings you along. He can snow you the way he can't snow her," Leo says. "She was there. She's never met the new and improved Joseph Weber. She knows an animal, a beast. Eventually, if he can get to her through you, he can kill her, or he can get you to convince her he's a changed man who deserves forgiveness. Either way, he wins." I stare at him, a little hurt that he would think this of me. "You really believe I would do that?" He pulls into my driveway, but there's already a car waiting there. Adam gets out of the driver's seat, holding a bouquet of lilies. "People need forgiveness for all sorts of reasons," Leo says flatly. "I think you, of all people, understand that. And I think Joseph Weber's got your number." He puts both hands on the steering wheel, staring straight ahead. In my lap, Eva starts to bark at the stranger outside who holds up a hand in an awkward wave. "I'll be in touch," Leo says. For the first time in 2 days, he doesn't look me in the eye. "Be careful," Leo adds, a goodbye that I know has nothing to do with Joseph. The lilies would be nice if not for the fact that I know Adam gets a deep discount with a local florist, something he told us while we were making my mother's funeral arrangements. In fact, for all I know, this bouquet was just a leftover from the morning service. "I don't really feel like talking," I say, pushing past him, but he catches my arm and pulls me close and kisses me. I wonder if Leo is far enough down the street yet, or if he sees us. I wonder why I care. "There she is," Adam murmurs against my lips. "I knew the girl I'm crazy about was in there somewhere." "Actually, she's across town, roasting a chicken for your dinner tonight. I can understand that it's hard to keep track." "I deserve that," Adam says, following me into my house. "But that's why I'm here, Sage. You've got to hear me out." He leads me into the living room. I realize that we do not spend a lot of time in there. When he comes over, we mostly go right to the bedroom. He sits me down on the couch and holds my hand. "I love you, Sage Singer. I love the way you have to sleep with one foot uncovered, and the fact that you hog the popcorn when we watch a movie. I love your smile and your widow's peak. It's a cliche, I know, but seeing you with that guy yesterday made me realize how much I have to lose. I don't want someone else to snatch you away while I'm dragging my feet over a decision. Pure and simple, I love you and I want to be with you forever." Adam drops to one knee, still holding my hand. "Sage, marry me?" I stare at him, stunned. And then I burst out laughing, which I'm pretty sure is not the reaction he was hoping for. "Aren't you forgetting something?" "The ring, I know, but not the ring.
The fact that you have a wife. Well, of course not, Adam says, sitting down on the couch again. That's why I came here. I'm filing for divorce. I sink back against the cushions, shell-shocked. There are so many ways a family can unravel. All it takes is a tiny slash of selfishness, a rip of greed, a puncture of bad luck. And yet, woven tightly, family can be the strongest bond imaginable. I lost my mother and father. I pushed my sisters away. My grandmother had her parents torn from her. We have spent decades patching up the holes. And yet here is Adam, cavalierly throwing away his loved one so that he can start over. I'm ashamed at myself, for the role I had in bringing him to this point. I only hope it's not too late for him to realize what I'm just beginning to see myself. Having a family means you're never alone. Adam, I say softly, go home. This time, it's for real. I've told Adam that it's over, but now I mean it. And I know it's different because I cannot breathe. I cannot stop sobbing. It's as if I'm grieving over someone I loved, which I guess is entirely true. Adam had not wanted to leave. You don't mean it, he told me. You're not thinking clearly. But I was. Possibly for the first time in 3 years. I was seeing myself the way Mary had seen me, and Leo, and I was embarrassed. I love you enough to marry you, he said. What more could you possibly want? There were so many ways to answer that question. I wanted to walk down the street on the arm of a good-looking guy and not have other women wonder why he was with someone who looked like me. I wanted to be happy, but not if it meant someone else would be devastated. I wanted to feel beautiful instead of just lucky. The only reason Adam left was because I convinced him, through my tears, that he was only making this even harder for me, that if he really cared about me, he'd go. You don't want to do this, he insisted. The same words Joseph had said to me during our chess game. But sometimes, in order to win, you have to make sacrifices. When my eyes are so red I cannot see clearly, and my nose is stuffed from crying, I curl up on the sofa and hug Eva to my chest. My cell phone starts buzzing in my pocket, and Adam's number flashes on the screen. I shut it off. My home phone starts ringing too, and before I hear Adam's voice on the message machine, I unplug it and disconnect the phone. Right now, what I need is to be by myself. I swallow half a sleeping pill left over from after my mom's funeral and fall asleep fitfully on the couch. I dream that I'm in a concentration camp, wearing my grandmother's striped prisoner's dress, when Joseph comes for me in his officer's uniform. Although he is an old man, his grip is a vice. He doesn't smile, and he speaks only in German, and I can't understand what he's asking of me. He drags me outside to a courtyard as I stumble, my knees bruising on rocks. There, Adam stands beside a coffin. He lifts me into it. It's about time, he says. When he reaches to shut the lid, I realize his intentions and I start to fight him. But even when I'm able to scratch and draw blood, he's stronger than I am. He closes the lid, although I'm gasping for air. Please, I yell out, pounding my fists against the satin lining. Can you hear me? But no one comes. I keep beating, hammering. Are you there? I hear, and I think maybe it's Leo, but I'm afraid to shout because it will use up too much oxygen. I struggle to breathe in, and my lungs fill with the scent of my grandmother's talcum powder. I wake up to find Adam shaking me, and daylight streaming through the windows. I've been asleep for hours. Sage, are you all right? I'm still groggy, sleepy, dry-mouthed. Adam, I slur, I told you to go away. I was worried about you since you weren't picking up your phone,
Reaching down into the folds of the couch, I find my iPhone and turn it on. There are dozens of messages. One from Leo, three from my grandmother, a handful from Adam, and oddly, a half dozen from each of my sisters. "Pepper called me about the arrangements," he says. "God, Sage, I know how close you were to her, and I want you to know I'm here for you." I start to shake my head, because even as fuzzy as it feels, everything is starting to fall into place. I take a deep breath, and all I can smell is talcum. What Daisy tells me and my sisters is that Nana was feeling tired and lay down for a nap at about 2 o'clock that afternoon. When she didn't wake up in time for dinner, Daisy was afraid she'd have trouble sleeping through the night, so she went into the bedroom and turned on the lights. She tried to wake my grandmother, but couldn't. "It happened in her sleep," Daisy tells us, tearful. "I know she wasn't in any pain." Me, I can't be certain. What if the stress Leo and I subjected her to was what had finally taken its toll on her? What if the memories we brought flooding back had swept her away? What if she was thinking of him in the moments before she died? I can't help but believe this is my fault, and because of that, I'm a mess. But I can't confide in Pepper and Saffron, because I already feel like they blame me for my mother's death, even though they said it was not my fault. I can't let them blame me for my grandmother's death, too. So mostly I stay out of their way, grieving in private, and they leave me alone. I think they're a little afraid at how much of a zombie I've become in the wake of Nana's death. I don't mind when they invade my home and rearrange the furniture so that we can sit Shiva. I don't complain when they go through my refrigerator throwing out yogurt that's out of date or griping because I don't have any decaf. I stop eating, even when Mary comes by with a basket full of fresh-baked pastries and condolences. When she tells me she's lit a candle for my grandmother before every mass since hearing of her passing. I don't tell my sisters about Leo or Reiner Hartmann. I don't try to call Joseph in the hospital. I just say that I've been spending a lot of time with Nana lately, and that's why I'd like a few minutes alone with her at the funeral home before the ceremony. My grandmother lived a remarkable life. She watched her nation fall to pieces, and even when she became collateral damage, she believed in the power of the human spirit. She gave when she had nothing. She fought when she could barely stand. She clung to tomorrow when she couldn't find footing on the rock ledge of yesterday. She was a chameleon, slipping into the persona of a privileged young girl, a frightened teen, a dreamy novelist, a proud prisoner, an army wife, a mother hen. She became whomever she needed to be to survive, but she never let anyone else define her. By anyone's account, her existence had been full, rich, important. Even if she chose not to shout about her past, but rather to keep it hidden. It had been nobody's business but her own. It was still nobody's business. I would make sure of that. After everything I'd done by involving Leo and having him interview her, it was the least I could do. Lightheaded with hunger and heat and grief, I move woodenly from Pepper's rental car to the lobby of the funeral home, where Adam is waiting in his dark suit. He greets Pepper first. "I'm so sorry for your loss," he says smoothly. Does it even mean anything to him anymore? If you say the same words over and over, do they become so bleached that there's no color left in them? "Thank you," Pepper says, taking the hand he offers. Then he turns to me. "I understand you'd like a moment alone with your loved one." "Adam, it's me," I think, and then I remember that I'm the one who pushed him away. He steers me through a doorway into the back of the funeral home, while Pepper takes a seat and starts texting. Maybe the florist, the caterer, or her husband and kids who will be landing at the airport any minute now. It isn't until the door to the room is closed behind us that Adam folds me into an embrace. I stiffen at first, and then just give in. It's easier than putting up a fight. "You look like hell," he sighs into my hair.
Have you slept at all in the past 2 days?
I can't believe she's gone, I say, tearing up. I'm all alone now.
You could have me. Really? Now? I bite my lip and take a step away from him. Are you sure you want to do this?
I nod.
Adam takes me to the anteroom where my grandmother's casket is waiting, ready to be transferred to the sanctuary in time for the service. The small space smells like the inside of a refrigerator, cold and faintly antiseptic. My head spins, and I have to hold on to the wall for support. Could I have a minute alone with her? Adam nods and gently opens the upper half of the casket so that I'm looking down at my grandmother. The door closes behind him as he steps outside. She's wearing a red wool skirt with black piping. The blouse that's tied at her neck blooms like a flower against her throat. Her eyelashes cast shadows on her cheeks, which look lightly flushed. Her silver hair is swept and styled, the way she's had it done twice a week at the salon for as long as I can remember. Adam and his staff have outdone themselves. Looking at her, I find myself thinking of Sleeping Beauty, of Snow White, of women who woke from their nightmares and began to live again. If that happened to my grandmother, it would not be the first time. When my mother died, I didn't want to touch her. I knew my sisters would lean down and kiss her cheek, embrace her one last time. But for me, the moment of physical contact with a dead body was terrifying. It would feel different from all the other times I'd turned to her for comfort, because she couldn't hug me back. And if she couldn't hug me back, I had to stop pretending it was possible. Now, though, I don't have a choice. I reach into the casket and lift my grandmother's left hand. It's cold and oddly firm, like the dolls I had when I was a little girl that were advertised for their lifelike feel, which was never really lifelike at all. I unbutton her cuff so that the sleeve slides backward, exposing the flesh of her forearm. The casket will be closed at the funeral. No one will see the tattoo she was given at Auschwitz. And even if someone were to look inside, like I did, her silk blouse would cover the evidence. But my grandmother went to such great pains to keep from being defined by her experience as a survivor that I feel like it's my duty to make sure this continues, whatever comes next. From my purse, I pull a small tube of concealer and carefully blot it onto my grandmother's skin. I wait for it to dry, making sure the numbers have been obliterated. Then I button her cuff again, and folding my hands around hers, press a kiss into her palm like a marble to carry with her. Nana, I say, when I grow up, I'm going to be as brave as you. I close the casket and wipe beneath my eyes with my fingers, trying not to mess up my mascara. Then I take a few deep breaths and walk unsteadily into the hallway that leads to the lobby of the funeral home. Adam is not waiting for me outside the anteroom. It doesn't matter, though, because I know my way around here. I walk down the hallway, my ankles wobbling in the black pumps I'm not accustomed to wearing. In the foyer, I see Adam and Pepper bent in quiet conversation with a third party, whose body is blocked by their own. I assume it's Saffron, arriving before the rest of the guests. When they hear my footsteps, Adam turns, and suddenly I can see that the person they're talking to isn't Saffron at all. The room spins like a carousel. Leo? I whisper, certain I have imagined him, until he catches me the moment before I hit the floor.
For a long time, I simply cried. Every day, at noon, Alex was brought to the village square and punished for what his brother had done. It would have killed an ordinary man. Instead, for Alex, it was just a new circle of hell. I stopped baking. The village, without bread, grew bitter. There was nothing to break at the table with family, to digest over conversation. There were no pastries to pass to a lover. People felt empty inside, no matter how much other food they ate. One day I left the cottage and traveled by foot to the nearest city. It was the one Alex and his brother had last come from, where the buildings were so tall it hurt to try to see the tops of them. There was a special building there full of books, as many books as there were grains in a flour sack. I told the woman at the desk in the front what I needed, and she led me down a curved set of iron stairs to a place where leather tomes were nestled into the walls. I learned that there is more than one way to kill an upyor. You could bury a body deep in the ground, weighted down in the belly with rich soil. You could drive a nail into his brain. You could grind up a caul, like the one Casimir had been born with, and feed it to him. Or you could find the original corpse and slice open its heart. The blood of its victims would pour out. Some of these may have been old wives' tales, but this last one I knew was true. Because if Alex cut open his heart, I was certain that I would be the one to bleed to death.
Leo. She looks like a raccoon. An exhausted, dazed, beautiful raccoon. There are black circles under her eyes, from her makeup, and a lack of sleep, I'm guessing, and two high spots of color on her cheeks. The funeral director, who also happens to be the same married boyfriend I met a few nights ago, as if this town weren't small enough already, gave me a compress to put on her forehead, which has matted her bangs and dripped a damp ring around the collar of her black dress. "Hey," I say as Sage opens her eyes. "I hear you have a habit of doing this." "Let me just say that I'm doing everything I can not to get sick right here in the office of the funeral director. The whole place creeps me out, which is pretty astounding for someone who scours photographs of concentration camp victims all day long." "Are you okay?" Sage asks. "I'm the one who's supposed to be asking you that." She sits up. "Where's Adam?" "Wow." Just like that, an invisible wall cleaves the space between us. I rock back on my heels, putting distance between the couch where she's lying and myself. "Of course," I say formally. "I'll get him for you."
"I didn't say I wanted you to get him."
Sage's voice is as thin as a twig.
"How did you know?"
She doesn't finish her sentence. She doesn't have to. "I called you when I got back to D.C., but you didn't pick up the phone. I started to get worried. I know you think a 95-year-old isn't a threat, but I've seen guys that age pull a gun on a federal agent. Anyway, someone finally picked up the phone. Your sister Saffron. She told me about Minka." I look at her. "I'm so sorry, Sage. Your grandmother was a very special woman."
"What are you doing here, Leo?"
"I think that should be pretty obvious."
"I know you're here for the funeral," she interrupts. "But why?"
Various reasons run through my head. Because being here is the right thing to do. Because there is a precedent in the office for coming to the funerals of survivors who've been witnesses. Because Minka was part of my investigation. But really, the reason I'm here is that I wanted to be. For Sage. I didn't know your grandmother, of course, the way you did. But I could tell just by the way she looked at you when you didn't know she was looking that family came first for her. It's like that for a lot of Jews. Almost as if it's in the collective unconscious. Because once it got taken away. I glance at Sage. Today I thought maybe I could be your family. At first Sage doesn't move. Then I realize that tears are streaming down her cheeks. I reach for her, right through that invisible wall until I'm holding her hand. "So, no biggie, but is this good crying, like you're happy to send another place at Thanksgiving, or bad crying like you just found out your long-lost relative is a creeper?" A laugh bubbles out of her.
"I don't know how you do that."
"Do what?"
"Make it so I can breathe again," Sage says. "But thank you."
Whatever barrier I thought was between us is completely gone now. I sit next to her on the couch, and Sage rests her head on my shoulder simply, as if she's been doing it her whole life.
"What if we did this to her?"
"You mean by getting her to talk about what happened?"
She nods.
I can't shake the feeling that if I hadn't ever brought it up, if you hadn't shown her the pictures,
you don't know that. Stop beating yourself up.
It just feels so anticlimactic, you know?
She says, her voice small.
To survive the Holocaust and then die in her sleep. What's the point?
I think for a moment.
The point is that she got to die in her sleep. After having lunch with her granddaughter and a very dapper, charming attorney.
I'm still holding Sage Singer's hand. Her fingers fit seamlessly between mine. Maybe she didn't die upset. Maybe she let go, Sage, because she finally felt like everything was going to be okay. It is by all accounts a lovely service, but I don't pay attention. I'm too busy looking around the room to see if Reiner Hartmann shows up, because there's still a part of me that believes it's possible. When I realize that he's probably not going to come, I focus my attention on Adam, who is standing unobtrusively near the back of the sanctuary the way a funeral director should, trying hard not to stare at me every time Sage grabs onto my arm or buries her face in the sleeve of my suit jacket. I'm not gonna lie. It feels pretty damn good. When I got dumped in high school by a girl who wanted a more popular, studlier date on a Friday night, my mother used to say, "Leo, don't you worry. The geeks shall inherit the earth." I'm starting to believe this might actually be true. My mother would also tell me that hitting on a woman who's grieving at her grandmother's funeral is a one-way ticket to hell. I don't recognize any of the mourners except for Daisy, who's sobbing softly into a linen handkerchief. At the end of the service, Adam announces when and where shiva calls can be made. He also lists two charities, suggested by Pepper, where donations can be sent in Minka's memory. At the graveside, I stand beside Sage, who sits between her two older sisters. They look like her, but overblown. Birds of paradise flanking a primrose. When it's time for Sage to throw dirt into the grave, her hands are shaking. She tosses three handfuls. The rest of the mourners, a collection of both elderly people and friends of Sage's parents, from what I can gather, throw handfuls of dirt as well. After it's my turn, I catch up to Sage, and without saying a word, she slips her hand into mine again. Sage's house, which has been commandeered by her sisters to host a post-funeral gathering for friends and family, looks nothing like the home I was in just a few days ago. Furniture has been rearranged to accommodate the crowd. The mirrors have already been covered for mourning. Food is spread on every horizontal surface. Sage looks at the throngs of people streaming in the front door and takes a shuddering breath.
Everyone's going to try to talk to me. I can't do this.
Yes, you can. I'm not going anywhere, I promise. As soon as we walk inside, people swarm around Sage to offer their condolences.
Your grandma was my bridge partner,
one nervous bird-like woman says. A meatball of a man with a gold pocket watch and a handlebar mustache, who reminds me of the guy in the Monopoly chance cards, hugs Sage tightly, rocking her small frame back and forth.
You poor thing, he says.
A balding man holding a sleeping toddler in his arms catches my eye.
I didn't know Sage was dating someone.
He awkwardly sticks out his hand, which is caught under the chubby knee of his son.
Welcome to the circus. I'm Andy. Pepper's other half.
Leo, I say, shaking his hand. But Sage and I realize I have no idea what she's told her family. It's certainly at her discretion to explain what's going on with Joseph Weber, if she sees fit, but I'm not going to be the one to break the news to them if Sage hasn't. We're just working together, I finish. He looks at my suit dubiously.
You don't look like a baker.
I'm not. We met through, well, Minka.
She was something else, Andy says. Last year for Hanukkah, Pepper and I got her a trip to a fancy salon for a manicure. She liked it so much, she asked if for her birthday we could get her a pedophile.
He laughs. But Sage is overheard. You think it's funny that English wasn't her first language, Andy? How much Polish and German and Yiddish do you speak?
He looks horrified.
I don't think it's funny. I thought it was sweet.
I put my arm around Sage's shoulder and steer her in the opposite direction. Why don't we see if your sisters need a hand in the kitchen? As I lead her away from Pepper's husband, Sage frowns.
He's such a dick.
Maybe, I say. But if he wants to remember your grandmother with a smile, that's not such a bad thing. In the kitchen, Pepper is putting sugar cubes into a glass bowl. I understand not buying creamer because of the fat content, but do you really not have milk, Sage? She asks. Everyone has milk, for God's sake.
I'm lactose intolerant, Sage mutters.
I notice that when she talks to her sisters, her shoulders hunch, and she seems like a smaller, paler version of herself. Like she's trying to be even more invisible than usual.
Just bring it out there, Saffron says. The coffee's cold already.
Hi, I announce. My name's Leo. Is there anything I can do to help? Saffron looks up at me, then at Sage.
Who's this?
Leo, I repeat. A colleague.
You bake? She says doubtfully.
I turn to Sage. Okay, so which is it? Do bakers wear clown suits or something, or do I dress like an accountant?
You dress like an attorney, she replies. Go figure.
Well, good, Saffron says, sailing past us with her platter. Because it's completely criminal that there's not a single decent deli in this entire state. How am I supposed to feed 60 people with pastrami from Price Chopper?
You used to live here, you know, Sage calls out after her.
When her sisters bustle out of the kitchen and we're alone, I hear crying. But it's not Sage, and she hears it too. She traces the sound to the pantry and opens the door to find Eva, the dachshund, trapped inside.
I bet this is a nightmare for you, she murmurs, picking the dog up in her arms. But she's looking at all the people gathered to celebrate her grandmother's life. People who want to make her center of their attention as they share memories.
While she's still holding the dachshund in one arm, I pull her through the back door of the kitchen, down a set of stairs, and across her rear lawn to the spot where I've parked my rental car.
Leo! She cries. What are you doing?
So, I ask, as if she's not spoken, when was the last time you ate? It's only a courtyard by Marriott, but I order a bottle of crappy red wine and a bottle of even worse white, a French onion soup and chicken Caesar salad, buffalo wings and mozzarella sticks, and a cheese pizza. Fettuccine Alfredo, 3 scoops of chocolate ice cream, and a colossal slice of lemon meringue pie. There's food enough for me, Sage, Eva, and the rest of the fourth floor where I incline to invite them. Any reservations I have about kidnapping a grieving girl from her own house where she's supposed to be sitting Shiva for her grandmother and smuggling a dog into a pet-free hotel are allayed by the fact that the color has started to come back to Sage's face as she works her way through the bounty in front of her. The room, made for business travelers, has a small sitting area with a couch and a television. We've turned it to Turner Classic Movies with the volume low. Jimmy Stewart and Katharine Hepburn are on the screen arguing with each other.
Why do people in old movies always sound like their jaws are wired together? Sage asks.
I laugh.
It's a little-known fact that Cary Grant suffered from TMJ. You're lit from within, Tracy. You've got fires banked down in you. Hearth fires and holocausts.
We both look up at that line. That word.
I don't seem to you made of bronze.
No. You're made out of flesh and blood. That's the blank, unholy surprise of it. You're the golden girl, Tracy, full of life and warmth and delight. What goes on? You've got tears in your eyes.
Shut up. Shut up.
Oh, Mike. Keep talking. Keep talking.
Talk, will you?
No one from the 1940s ever sounds like trailer trash, Sage muses.
As Jimmy Stewart leans close to Katharine Hepburn, she dubs a line for him.
Say you'll go out with me, Mabel. I know you're out of my league, but I can always start bowling on Tuesday nights instead.
I grin, speaking over Katharine Hepburn's scripted response.
I'm sorry, Ralph. I could never love a man who thinks loading the dishwasher means getting your wife drunk. But sugar, Sage continues, what am I going to do with these NASCAR tickets?
Katharine Hepburn tosses her hair.
Hell if I care, I say.
Sage smiles. This is a missed opportunity for Hollywood. She turned off her phone because her sisters will be calling her nonstop once they discover her departure. At one end of the couch, the dog is snoring. The screen abruptly fills with the carnival colors of a commercial. After watching something that's so black and white, it's overwhelming. I suppose it's done now, Sage says. I check my watch, and the movie's got another half hour. I was talking about Reiner Hartmann. I reach for the remote and mute the television. We don't have the possibility of a deposition from your grandmother anymore, much less a video testimony.
I could tell a court what she said.
That's hearsay, I explain.
It doesn't seem fair.
Sage tucks her leg beneath her on the couch. She's still wearing her black dress from the funeral, but she's barefoot.
That she would die and he would still be alive. It feels like such a waste. Like she should have lived to tell her story, you know?
She did, I point out. She told it to you for safekeeping. And now that she's gone, maybe it's yours to tell. I can tell Sage hasn't thought about her grandmother's death that way. She frowns and then gets up from the couch. Her purse is an oversized black hole, from what I can see. I can't imagine what's inside it. But she rummages around inside and pulls out a leather notebook. It looks like something Keats might have carried around in his purse, if that was in style back then.
The story? The one she talked about that saved her life? She rewrote it after the war. Last week, for the first time, she showed it to me.
Sage sits back down.
I think she'd like you to hear it, she says. I'd like you to hear it.
When was the last time someone read aloud to you? Probably when you were a child. And if you think back, you'll remember how safe you felt, tucked under the covers or curled in someone's arms, as a story was spun around you like a web. Sage begins to tell me about a baker and his daughter, a soldier drunk with power who loves her, a string of murders linked like pearls throughout the village. I watch her as she reads. Her voice begins to take on the roles of the character